wake up in your face on the bedroom carpet. Count back all the ways that you ended up there. Can't remember someone else's story. You can't remember that you don't feel sorry. So get up, get out. Lines are gone.
Hi everyone, welcome to Under My Host. I'm Corey. Today joining me, Brian Sullivan, the head brewer and co-founder of Steady Hand Brewing Company.
Beer company.
Beer company.
Nice.
And we have producer Maddie joining us as usual. I shouldn't say as always, as usual.
Assistant brewer at Steady.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
Matt, exactly. Matt Pond is joining us. Matt Pond, musician and spirits enthusiast, and hopefully one day a distillery co-founder. We have Todd Leopold of Leopold Brothers, head distiller, co-founder, all that great stuff. And then we have new to the show, we've got Steve Burt. Berthel. Okay. Yeah. So, but he goes by Bert. So that's what we're going to call him. So he is the head brewer at the Brew Pub for New Holland. So we're going to talk, we'll catch up with Todd Leopold during the show, find out what he's doing. And I really wanted to touch on the show, the farmer producer relationship, which we touched on a little bit last week, but Todd's in Colorado, and of course New Holland is a different, they're all Michigan guys actually. Todd Leopold started out in Michigan. In 2008 they moved out to Colorado, and if you want to learn more about Leopold Brothers, please just listen to the show. I don't want to make him talk about stuff we've already talked about, so we'll try to touch on new stuff. And there's a New Holland show that we did Rich Blair do the show with us? I know Fred did, but I can't remember if Rich joined
Rich
in.
Did as well. Mm.
Oh no, I think it was the distiller for New Holland that joined us.
Oh yeah. You're right.
So
you're
both
right.
Of those shows exist. So if you want to know more about the companies, you can listen. But so welcome everybody.
Hello.
Everybody's like chillaxing. Todd, it's been a while. Okay. I mean, I keep up with you a lot offline, but how are you doing?
Good. Just kind of starting to get caught up here from the holidays. For most distilleries, their busiest time of year is October, November, December. And so you just get through by the skin of your teeth, and you spend, or we do anyways, we spend January trying to refill all of the wholesalers' warehouses, basically, because we usually make it through by 10 or 20 cases on a lot of the things that we make. So rather than resting in January, you're just kind of going as crazy as you were in December, but things are going well. And my daughter Ellie is 14 months old now, and she's keeping us busy. She learned to walk 2 weeks ago and learned to sprint 1 week ago.
I know, I saw, and I love it. He refers to Ellie as, he does little narratives. So whenever he shares anything about his daughter, she's and our hero, which is really, it's very cute. So it's like a, you know, he explains like what she's done. There's a little picture with a little, yeah. Anyway, I enjoy it.
So we have a lot of grandmas on our Facebook feed. That's what that's all about.
Oh, that's not for me, Todd?
No, no. No, we're just trying to keep the grandmas that are all around the country happy and making sure that they don't miss one little thing. I've learned how important, not that it's not important to us, but grandmas and grandpas, I think they just kind of hang on every picture and word. So we try. I figure if Facebook's not for that, what the hell is it for? So.
Yeah, exactly. What? She's spending a lot of time in the distillery too, because you remember he talked about he's got to have children to carry on the legacy.
Yeah.
So he's really got her in there.
Absolutely.
She's got the little, she's got his overalls even.
Seriously? Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, we're teaching her. She's already starting to, I wouldn't call it nosing, but, you know, when we go to the grocery store, I do two things. I point things out to her. So, you know, so we're trying to build her vocabulary and colors and boxes and textures and all that kind of stuff. But we also, she's patient enough that she'll smell things without touching them, which I find amazing. I don't think I had that self-control at her age. But,
or now, really, even.
Right, no, exactly. That's a good point. But we're slowly breaking her in, and we got the new still up and installed and running, and malting is coming along really well for us, and so I think this year we're kind of finally hitting on all cylinders. So we're excited for this year.
I want to talk to Bert real quick since he's not been on the show, and just so we can become familiar with him. But I do want to talk about your new still, and for you to explain to everybody how the still is different than the ones that you have had already in the distillery. But you know Bert, or at least Bert remembers meeting you when you were in Michigan. Are you familiar?
Yeah, Todd, I had a craft brew brewery in Kalamazoo the same time you had your brewery in Ann Arbor.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I was brewing lagers over here.
Oh, no, I remember that. There. It's a wonderful place.
Yeah.
Very cool.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah, I know. Michigan seems like 1,000 years ago, even though we left in 2008, and reading the papers these days and reading about what's happening up in, I shouldn't laugh. It's
terrible. The water.
Oh, in Flint.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I don't miss Michigan politics.
That's, our cross to bear, I guess, for having the Great Lakes. But
yeah, unfortunately. So
be thankful that none of us have a brewery in Flint right now, I think.
Yeah. I can't even imagine I don't even know where to start with that. I don't even know what textbooks I'd turn to. How the hell do you get lead out of...
Children, let alone water. I mean, it's the kids that are getting so sick, right?
Yeah.
Everybody, actually, but kids are more prone than elderly people, apparently, so...
The whole thing's very, very sad, and I still obviously have a whole lot of people from Facebook friends, from a lot of musicians, actually, Mr. Pond. All Music Guide is up that way, so you've got a lot of...
All right.
Yeah, journalists and people, some of your label mates, Saturday Looks Good to Me, or previous mates. And, so it's kind of been filling my Facebook feed with... the travails and issues going on in Flint right now. So not exactly happy news. So no. I'm cutting you off. Let's talk about New Holland. Pardon me.
Good segue.
So why don't you know? Of course, like we've heard about New Holland, but why don't you tell us a little bit about you, and then tell us about the brew pub?
All right. Well, I started brewing in Kalamazoo in about 1996 at the Craft Brow. And I stayed there, the big main employer in Kalamazoo, besides Checker Motors and stuff, was Upjohn Company, pharmaceutical company. And, they sold to a Swedish company called Pharmacia, which then sold to Pfizer in, 2003, around there. And they swore that there was only going to be about 400 jobs lost, but it was more like 4,000 in our city. And it pretty much... kicked our whole client base right in the ass. And it was tough here in Kalamazoo for a few years because so many people had to move out.
Yeah.
So I got some people cold called me about opening a brewery in Benton Harbor. And so I looked at this old building and what kind of renaissance was happening in this town, and couldn't make anything happen in Kalamazoo. So I opened a brewery in 2005 there called Delivery. And kind of made my mark as a brewer there. I was doing a lot of barrel-aged sour beer spontaneously, like Ron Jeffries does at Jolly Pumpkin. We were good friends and had kind of the same vision on what we wanted, although our beers were, totally different from each other. I got into doing a lot of high-gravity lagers and barrels, which nobody was doing at that time. And, I just had a small brewery, never got above 500 barrels, and... one thing led to another, and in 2012, I left that company and went to work for New Holland. I'd known the partners at New Holland, Fred, the longest probably, because he was a musician, still is, and used to play at Bell's here in Kalamazoo, where I live. So, I just went to those guys and was looking for a graceful way to exit this, situation I was in at Delivery. And they asked me what I was going to do, and I said, well, probably end up working in a bike shop or a ski shop, and they're like, well, we have a job. And so they offered me the job as the pub brewer down there. And, we're opening a new location in Grand Rapids. So that was kind of like the carrot on the stick. We've got this new location. We'd like you to run that. Well, first building fell through. So, you know, I'm going into my second year at New Holland at the pub, and after being a brewer for 18 years, it's like, you know, what do you do that's different than what nobody else is doing? And I was, you know, 59 years old at the time. I made a proposal to the partners to say, how about if we do every single beer at the pub with all Michigan-sourced ingredients? And so my goal was to be 100% by 2016. Well, we're about a week in now, a little over a week, and I'm about 95% now. And I deal with three different maltsters in the state and about six different hop suppliers. And Michigan now is number four in the nation for hop production and rapidly growing. It's just going crazy here. So, you know, it's been we started this last April and kicked off an All Michigan Saison. And the cool thing is, it's really taken this to a whole nother level for me, is they have managed to establish a yeast propagation company, kind of like White Labs or Y Yeast, up in the Upper Peninsula. And they have found two ale strains on the shores of Lake Superior and Eagle River at the tip of the Keweenaw that are some of the best Belgian style of yeast strains I've ever used in my life, and a wild lager strain, which is my house lager strain, in an orchard of all places.
That's very cool. And I have a feeling, Todd, you know, Todd's over there perking up. I can hear him from Colorado.
So, you know, it's been pretty crazy. So we had all the suppliers I deal with, the mayor of Holland, all the Tulip Time people, people from Craftworks, Tankworks, the Brewers Guild folks, everybody came in. We had like almost 30 people for a day making this Michigan's first 100% sourced Saison.
Nice.
And it was a great day, not too many dry eyes at the end of the day, because it's everybody that was there, the farmers, the maltsters, the hop growers, the processors, everybody was seeing a vision and a dream coming true for one afternoon in their little brewery, you know? So that's kind of was their first batch of beer, and I've done probably now over 50 different styles of all Michigan ingredients since then. So it's been pretty crazy trying to, you know, try out new malts. You know, you really don't have an idea what you're going to get. The barley's a fragile crop. Frankly, I'm not getting quite the yields I get off continental malt, but, you know, every month gets a little better as these people learn the tricks of the trade, and I stay in constant contact with everybody, from the yeast people to the hop people and to the barley people mostly, because they're the ones with the most challenges on their plate right now. So it's been pretty wild, and so, you know, I've been working with Michigan State Extension Services. They do grants for the barley farmers, and they have a huge test farm and lab now, thanks to some grants we were able to secure this year for soil analysis and plant analysis for the farmers that want to grow brewer's malt in barley. And as a member of the Brewers Guild, during my tenure there, we were able to secure grants for some of the hop farmers, and that was in its infancy. So now our focus is on the barley and the, you know, the malting. And so far, the Michigan terroir has just turned out fabulous results of flavors. My lagers, my English ales have never tasted better than they do now. And it's just been an amazing thing to be. I turned 61 in a couple of weeks, and it's like, you know, to be first at something. Be first at something in this industry that has like got so many trendsetters and movers and shakers, to be able to do something in my state that's actually doing good for our communities, our brewers, our breweries, and the farmers that work so hard to grow the stuff. So, really cool.
It is very cool. And of course, I think when I first talked to Fred, you know, I have a relationship with Farm Aid, where my magazine is working with Farm Aid, and I'm working with Farm Aid, and I talked to them because I really wanted to talk to a few people that I know that were involved in some of these initiatives, because the reality is when you approach a farmer who's never grown malt, or they've, you know, like the grains and or hops, you have to have a producer who's willing to work with stuff that is not going to be something you get from Hop Union, or, you know, there's a process where you have to be patient and allow these guys to perfect what they're growing. It's new for them. It may not be the same. And that was something Fred was really honest about, like that they were willing to see it through, allow these guys to I guess, like, you know, like, I guess you give them feedback, right? So when, you're right. And I think that's wonderful. And I think it's really important, especially when you think of a lot of the things that are going on in Michigan, not even when I'm talking about politics, but just the economy, that it's so nice that you're really lifting each other up and really supporting one another, because it's really important. And at the end of the day, if when you get a great product by doing that, I mean, that's like, you kind of like hit the sweet spot. I love this. This whole thing just like speaks to me. And I didn't really get a chance to. I always talk to Fred, really. So when I had approached him, I didn't realize that you were the one that was doing this stuff. So it's so cool to be able to talk to you. Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of championed this, and they were all for it. You know, New Holland's always had a commitment to local stuff, and our executive chef, Bill Bobian's an old friend of mine from the UP. They hired him, and I met him, and I'm like, holy crap, I haven't seen this guy in 26 years, you know? And now he's working with me, and we used to ski together in the UP. So, you know, I knew that this is something I've been thinking about for many years, and that, you know, I got with a company that I knew could financially absorb the extra costs in the infancy of these, mm-hmm. you know, industries, and would embrace it. And, you know, so basically for me, it's like, you know, I don't really have a boss. I don't have budget restraints. I don't have any direction from anybody. They just let me loose and I can do anything. So I'm laying Belgians and Bocks and, you know, lagers and all sorts of high gravity beers and barrels from our distillery now. And so once again, you know, not to use a horrifying cliche, but bringing it full circle, you know, and you know, it's just really cool to be able to reinvent all my beer styles that I've become known for in this many years of brewing with all Michigan grown ingredients. And right now the only hitch up in the get along is chocolate malt, roast barley, and dark crystal malts. And one of our malt suppliers, Wendell Banks, up in Shepherd, Michigan, Michigan Malting, mm-hmm. just took delivery of a roaster a week ago, so he's going to be playing with that. So I'm hoping within a month or so we should be getting some of that stuff, our hands on that. And then the other big malt company that just went in is Pilot Malting in Byron Center, just south of Grand Rapids. And they're kicking it out. They're doing smoked malts. They're doing Munich malts, Pilsner Pale, some brown malts and stuff. And they don't have a roaster yet, but they're planning on it, you know, this year. So everybody's kind of taking baby steps, getting their product out, you know. And I talk to these guys 2-3 times a week, you know, with feedback and just trying to convince fellow brewers to take a gamble and say, look, you know, do one beer year-round that's made with all Michigan ingredients and charge 50 cents a pint more. Nobody's going to bitch about that because it's for our state, you know, and it's for our livelihood, because the only thing that's bringing Michigan back is tourism right now. And a big linchpin in that is the wineries, the distilleries, and the breweries that are popping up, you know, and they have the distillery trail, the wine trail, and the beer trail. So people come here to recreate on the Great Lakes, as Todd knows, after living here. You know, it's huge tourism. So we have the Pure Michigan thing, and our brewery is the first brewery to be licensed to use the Pure Michigan logo for all my beer products now, in marketing, advertising, and everything. So that's pretty neat. You know, I mean, that was another big coup I was pushing for as well. So like I said, it's just really neat to be part of something that makes a difference, you know? And it's also cool to work for a company that allows me to bring my lifestyle into my job site, which, you know, I mean, I've been dealing with farm markets and CSAs for 25, 30 years. And, you know, I know the farmers that grow the food I eat, and I know the guys that raise the cattle and the bison and the pigs that I consume. And, you know, I go to the farm market every week, you know, and shop and know the same guys and gals that, you know, sell down there. Why should it be any different for the beverages you put down your throat, you know? You should know the people that grow that stuff, too, you know? It's just a full circle, once again, you know, to bring that all around to people and preach that gospel.
Yeah.
So, I've got a very unique position in that I've been on the board of directors for the Michigan Brewers Guild for 8 years. And I book all the entertainment for all of our festivals around the state that are sold out and MC the stage. So my soapbox on stage in front of 5,000-6,000 people is to talk about what we're talking about now, supporting local farmers, get your kids out into the CSA field and get their hands dirty and then take the food home and cook it and explain to them that Daddy's beer is made of all Michigan ingredients. You know, it's like all goes hand in hand. It's like bringing it all back to what our ancestors had a long time ago that a lot of people have forgotten about. So I think
you're
it's
like singing the most beautiful song
Corey's,
I've ever heard.
Corey's got the biggest smile on her face right now.
This is just all me. This is exactly what I'm about. I'm so happy that you're on the show talking about this stuff.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, why not? Really, I mean, I'm surprised it's just taken so long, you know, to get to this point where now people are starting to wake up and go, oh, yeah, you know, we can do this. And yeah, it costs a few bucks more. So what? They print money every day, you know? Make good beer with local stuff. No matter what state you're in, utilize what you got, you know, and broadcast that to people. Because that's where people's hearts are these days, I think, you know?
Yeah. So. I mean, right. Who else is going to care about Michigan more than people who are living in Michigan? So yeah, you definitely, tourism is great. But I mean, it's stuff like, you know, when you do hear, like, we don't have to get too much in the stuff with Flint, but you know, if you have to focus on the positive and try to move forward. And I think I love what you're doing. I'm definitely going to want to talk to you again after the show, but, we have one of the agro brews. We don't have anything from the pub. So we're drinking the collaboration that you guys did, the Carhartt Woodsman, there's three of the agro brews, but will any of the beers that you have created for the brew pub go into commercial production? Will we see any of, I mean, I know that will mean that the Michigan producers are, that you're getting enough of the ingredients, but is that a target for you guys to start actually selling this stuff outside of the state?
No, I don't know. I mean, that old saying, it's like I'm a mushroom. They keep me in the dark and they feed me, you know what, you know? I really honestly can't answer that question. I mean, I think it'd be awesome if they did. I mean, they're so close, but, you know, I mean, once again, I take it back to what I said before. If every brewery would do one beer with all Michigan ingredients, I mean, if they had one beer, like, say, Pale Loser, or if they took the Woodsman recipe and used all Michigan ingredients, you know, our suppliers could supply the malt for that right now and the hops, no problem, for one or two batches a year. But you start getting a brewery the size of Founders or Bell's or Arcadia or New Holland or Shorts or any of those, you know, I mean, right now there's, I don't see how their budgets could afford it, you know?
Yeah.
'Cause it'd be so much, I mean, I pay about, I don't know, probably about 35 to 40% more per pound for the Michigan barley and definitely more for the hops. But the whole catch 22 on this is the more people that buy the product, the prices will come down.
Right.
So it's, you know, if we can convince enough people, bigger breweries, like say maybe 3,000 to 7,000 barrel breweries, start doing a couple beers a year, we would see our prices come down to be competitive with, you know, maybe Continental malts. You know, maybe not Brees or Rahr, but, you know, definitely like, you know, Fawcett or Castle or any of those. So
what size barrel house do you have at the pub?
It's a 15 barrel Vendome system that was built in Louisville, Kentucky for the Bourbon Trail. So my kettle, it's beautiful copper, onion dome set into the floor. But the tube chamber would maybe hold a gallon of water. So it's not set up for making beer because your hops like float right into the chiller. So that was a big reason for me to start doing my lagers full force. So over 50% of what I brew is box and lagers. And
I was wondering where you have the room. I mean, you must have a lot of room there to store.
Well, it's just like I've got five fermenters, you know, 5 10-barrel fermenters. And so I'm doing about 8-barrel batches right now, you know, for the pub, and we're going to be getting more taps in. But, you know, I just dedicate a fermenter to my lager and a fermenter to my bock, and if it's in there for a month and a half or 2 months, that's fine, you know, in the bright tank and everything else. I don't rush it. I could care less, you know. We got plenty of beer to put on tap, you know, at New Holland. I mean, there's like, there must be like, you know, 15 production beers and then, you know, 9 to 10 of mine sometimes, depending on how the flow is going. But, you know, it's just, I never rush my beers. And I just, you know, like I said, they don't give me any direction or anything. So I looked at the system and go, you know, I can't do American style double IPAs or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I just can't physically do it.
Yeah.
So I do English ales. I got four hand pulls. So I do four, you know, beer engines, a real ale 24/7, and box and Belgian styles and lagers. And I really enjoy brewing those styles of beers anyway. And I'm an old school, you know, beer drinker. I think Anchor Liberty Ale is one of the best bottles of beer that's ever been brewed on the planet, and I still make an all-Michigan version of that. And I'm not a big fan of Citra hops and some of these new hybrids, so it doesn't bother me that the Michigan terroir will not allow that kind of flavor to come through in a hop, because I don't like it anyway.
What's so the profile that you see from the Michigan? Well, like, what are some of the profiles?
We've got three hop varieties right now that are proprietary to the state, not hybrids. They were found in ditches in northern Michigan. We have number one is Empire. It runs about a 7.5 alpha, depending on the year. Very herbaceous and floral, like a Mitfruh Hallertauer German hop, but definitely higher alpha. Then on the other side of the spectrum, we have a hop that's called Osiris, and that runs about 10.5 alpha, very, very spicy, like a Saaz. And then in the middle, we have a hop called Volvadina, which is a blend of both of them, which is about 9% alpha. All three of those hops have been traced back to Swedish DNA. So Swedish immigrants that came through Michigan had those.
Oh, nice.
That is
This is another full circle, because I'm 100% Swedish, so, you know, it's only appropriate that I'm here doing this with these hops. But all three of those hops are very excellent for doing, I like for my Vienna lagers, my Dunkel, my Doppelbox, you know, my box, I really like the Empire, the herbaceous part. And then for like German Pilsners, I like the Osiris. And then we have a Super Sazer that Hophead Farms is doing, which they said they couldn't grow a Saaz hop in Michigan. They proved them wrong. It's about 6.5 alpha and very, very nice hop, you know, Saaz spiciness, but just a little higher alpha. So you can actually bitter with them too. So, you know, those work good. And then Michigan Brewers Gold, Crystal, Fuggle are all good English hops. But we've got, like, you know, the sea hops, Centennial, Chinook, Cascade. They're coming through, and depending on what part of the state, you know, you're getting these from, they all have their own characteristics. So we've got about six varieties of Cascade in the state that are totally different. Same thing for Centennial. Same thing for Chinook. So my goal is, if I could ever pull this off, I would love to do, like, 12 smash beers with just single hops from all over the regions and put them on tap at the same time so people could see the difference in our Michigan terroir.
Like a vertical tasting?
Yeah, I know. And it'd be like, you know, from the west side to the north to the UP to the central to east, you know. And then I would check in the Betty Ford Clinic right after that.
Todd, are you, I mean, is this any of this, aren't you kind of like surprised? Old Michigan.
Well, I think it's fantastic to hear. Well, I think what's happening is the brewers are getting big enough that farmers are returning their phone calls. Yeah. Is the way I put it.
Or did you have a lot of unanswered calls?
Yeah. Oh, very much so.
What
so we opened in 99, I guess about 3 years after he did. And just what we were doing at the start was all organic. And so the only game in town for the beers I wanted to make, Vireman had organic, but we had to have it shipped direct. They didn't even have it in the wholesaler's warehouse. And then the hops that we got were all from Germany, because back then the only other hops that you could get that were organic were out of New Zealand, and in my opinion, not a very high quality.
Yeah, remember those Hallertauers you could get from New Zealand, like 15.5 alpha?
Right, no, exactly. You'd see that, and they're like, okay, guys, this is not the same hop. So what he's talking about is the Hallertauer is usually thought of as an aroma hop, and, you know, with the hops back then, at least, that would provide some unique aromas, more the traditional European hops. The alpha acid percentage would float somewhere around 4 or 5%. Once you start pushing past that, you're into what most people would call a bittering hop. So when he's saying, you know, 9% or 10%, now you're talking about what people would call high alpha hops, and that's usually what you would use, to, you know, as the driving force behind making an IPA.
Yeah.
So if you have something, you know, to I'm simplifying the math, but if you want to take an alpha acid hop that's about 5.5 and you want to make an IPA, you have to add so much hops into the kettle that, as he was explaining, you put so much hops in it, you can't get the damn thing back out. You can't spin them out in the whirlpool, and so the hops clog the heat exchanger. I'm nerding out too much.
Oh, please. We love it. I'm sitting here going, I love him so much.
So that's why these higher alpha hops are so necessary. Now, of course, what's happening now is that they're breeding for both. So you're getting both a high alpha and very interesting flavors, the flavors he just said he doesn't particularly care for. For me, I left the business right before, you know, right the hop IPA shortage hit, I think in 07. Mm-hmm. And really right after that is when you started to see more and more of these unusual hop varieties. But what's really happening overall is that we're basically reinventing food in America. And the biggest thing on the alcohol side is what we have that no one else had was prohibition.
Yeah.
So you used to be able to get barley and hops from New York State and all of these different, you know, juniper berries you could get, juniper communist. You could get these things domestically. Well, of course, the instant that that prohibition hit, all the farmers plowed it under and had to grow something else for the most part. So for a long time, for example, this in the late 1800s, for a good 15 years, the bulk of the barley that was used in Scottish distilleries came from California. So this is one of those things where our food, you know, where our food is coming from is starting to change back. And so if it sounds like he's inventing the wheel back there in Michigan, kind of is. We're rebuilding all of these structures. And to me, it's what he should be excited about, you know, because in the end, when we're pushing up daisies, you know, I just made beer, he just made beer, and that's great. But what he's doing is far more important. He's basically rebuilding an economy.
Yeah. Well, that's what I guess, like, I didn't really, my point really was, like, if you think about what's really kind of, you know, at one point almost destroyed Michigan was all this industry. And it'd be so crazy to think that agriculture and food and beer and wine, all of these things will be the thing that can maybe really help. And it may not, if it just kickstarts, but if it actually helps to get the economy going back, I mean, cause it's not even just the few places that he's mentioned. I've had friends from all different parts of Michigan, that, everybody, I don't know one part that's doing great. At least that, not from anybody. Parts of Michigan that I've never heard of, I have a friend that even, like, their family for years and years owned strip centers and there's nobody in there anymore. No, and nobody wants to buy.
Right.
It's so sad, but it's, you know, and I hate to even use, but it was a thing like Willie Nelson said, like, they created Farm Aid to save farms, and now the farmers are the ones that are saving everybody else. So.
Right.
No, I think it's super cool.
But to me, it's exciting. There's so many wonderful producers up there. I mean, you just spoke with Mr. Schramm.
Yeah,
know, what he's doing with honey and what he's doing with mead. I think it's a very, very important thing that he's handling up there. But, you know, I don't see any reason why, you know, we're running factories.
Yeah.
It may look cool and but, you know, make no bones about it. What we are factories now. Granted, they're not what you think of in a Ford assembly plant, but we are still taking something that's, you know, out of the ground. You know, in their case, they were taking, you know, metal and rubber and whatever the hell else. Well, metal doesn't, or the rubber doesn't come out of the ground, but you know what I mean.
No. Well, people get really confused when I refer to you guys as manufacturers. I mean, is the term. And so whatever, like, who are manufacturers? People that make your beer and your wine and your, like, well, not the wine, I don't really, but distilling. I'm like, those are manufacturers. Yeah. Todd, this was a good segue. I wanted to talk, when you brought up prohibition, and the grains. I want to talk about how you're resurrecting these grains. You know, what I don't know if a lot of people know, and it's something that we've talked about on different shows, was that rye was really the first big spirit. It wasn't bourbon. Yep. Bourbon was something that came later. And of course, before that, what I guess it was really when the British were coming down on the taxes. So it's like rum was the big spirit when all these, I don't even, know. Yep. What was that? Like 17, I don't even know the time frame.
Yeah. There
Johnny Depp.
Well, you know, all the way through even, you know, the 1600s. It's rum was the big thing.
Yeah.
And as well as apple brandy.
Well,
those were the were the two big things that really started things going. And then rye started popping up really in the 1800s in Pennsylvania and in Maryland. And really at the same time that bourbon did. And it's, you know, it's like everything throughout the world. You take whatever the hell is in your backyard, you ferment it, and you distill it. So,
but it did fall out of favor. Like it was a really popular spirit. Yeah.
Well, what happened, of course, you know, Prohibition was one thing that happened, and World War II was another thing that happened, and rationing, and the rise of, you know, the same thing that we're talking about reinventing. It was the rise of large manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, the same mentality that we had that went into cars eventually went into food. And so my brother and I like to joke when we go, we have our spirits in Kansas. You know, you'd think every block you'd be hitting one of the best bakeries in the world. It's the Grain Belt.
Yeah.
Why don't they have the best bakeries in the world? It's because they take all of the grain and they ship it up to Chicago or wherever, and Kraft or whatever large company takes it and processes it and sends it back. And
he means Kraft with a K.
right, exactly.
On its way to Mac and
Cheese. Know,
exactly.
You know, and it was, you know, neat at the time, and I think everybody is, you know, sat in front, or at my age anyways, I'm sorry. I think with Mr. Pond, are you in your 40s yet? Oh, let's not do that. Has had frozen dinners, and that, you know, that was neat at one point. And I think a lot of it in America, we're just kind of trying to turn things around. So on the grain side of things, what America's been doing is, and because it's so dominated by these larger companies and larger breweries and larger distilleries, is they've been farming for yield. And so what that means for grains is that you're farming for starch.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you're interested in. How much expressed as a percentage starch do you have in that kernel of rye or barley or corn? And so that's the first thing. And the second thing is, you know, how many pounds of that do you get per acre? And then how disease resistant are those things?
Yeah, it's not grown for flavor.
Right. You know, part of it isn't a horrible thing in the sense that, you know, if you're getting more yield out of the ground and you're trying to feed the world, that's not necessarily a horrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're trying to get more flavor, you know, out of it, the more starch you have, the less everything you have, the less what
nutrition.
You would consider giving rye its ryeness. So for us, we found a seed called a bruzy, and it's a type of rye seed that was used in the 1800s. And I think I'm the first person to ever send a grain in for testing who's thrilled that the yield was so low. the yield on this, you know, is about 5% less. But what it's going to show itself on multiple places and when we ferment it and distill it. So if it has 5% less overall starch, first of all, it gets the same alcoholic content in the distiller's beer. So when I mash it and I ferment it, I'm looking for a distiller's beer that's around 5%. And in order to get there, I'm having to add more of this rye, if that makes sense.
Right.
So I'm loading more rye in.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm adding more of this rye in. And to top it off, there's more flavor in each one of the, in every pound of rye, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So that we've been working on. The other thing that we have, we floor malt here on site. So we're doing about 10,000 pounds a week of two-row barley here that we're using at the distillery for our for a bourbon, for our rye, and for our vodka as well. And that's worked really well. We have a huge head start, of course, because of Coors. So Coors has been working with farmers for about 60-plus years, putting together really, really beautiful, what I consider to be flavorful barley. These farmers are used to very, very strict quality control parameters. So when you ask them to do something like the rye or the wheat, they can do it, you know, standing on their head.
Yeah.
It's very easy for them to do. The big advantage that we have out here is that it's so dry. So the dryness makes it so that you don't have as nearly as many problems with, you know, mildew and you know,
like
fungus and that kind of thing. Yeah, so we really have very, very clean, very, very bright flavors in all of our grains that we've been doing so far. So we're, by the end of the year here, we'll be 100% Colorado for the grains that we're going to be using.
Awesome.
Well, we also use potato for our vodka. They use potato as a rotational crop out here.
Mm-hmm. Between the barley
farmers use it to rotate through. So all of that, so for that particular strain that we resurrected, it's going into a new rye whiskey, and that's why we purchased that new still.
Right.
So, so the new still, and am I talking too much?
I don't know.
Never.
Okay.
I would like to address one statement that Todd made about this new old variety of rye that he found, and, you know, it's like lower yield and how excited he was.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing that I'm getting with my barley in the state of Michigan, lower yields and such, but the flavor is so phenomenal. There's nothing else out there that can compare. So sometimes you got to take a little bit less to get a little bit more.
That's exactly it. And I think it's, you know, when you're in our position and you get that lab report back, and well, of course, Jesus, it tastes completely different. Of course, it's going to have less starch,
right?
In it, and starch doesn't have flavor. So, you know, once you get that report and you chew on it for, you know, 10, 20 seconds, you're like, well, of course, this is what's going to wind up happening. But
well, because maybe at 5% may sound not like a big deal. I mean, it is a big deal when you're talking about like large, but you're not just only receiving, there's a 5% lower yield, but you're also having to use more grain. So it does, it is ultimately a more costly product. I mean, I don't think people understand why rye, that they understand, I just don't think they know about production, understand why rye production or rye whiskeys cost more to make. They're extremely well, and I want you to get into that because I really want you to talk about your still, but
well, sure.
How messy, how much more difficult it is to work with.
Well, it's interesting also the different approach you guys are approaching from. Less yield means you get to put more rye in, not that you have to put more rye in. You're like, it's
right, to understand, for a consumer to understand, like there's when you see that there's a higher price, especially people who are doing things like New Holland and Leopold Brothers, because sometimes that is for some people that's when they decide to buy something. I mean, people say that to me when I feature rye. Well, why is the rye so much? I mean,
because it's delicious.
Exactly.
And you should pay for a wonderful product because it's well made.
Thank you. Well, the price of the price of the grain for me, now this is just my opinion. Your mileage may vary. You're going to hear different opinions from other people. The price of the grain, particularly when, you know, for whiskey, I won't speak to beer as much because with all the crazy mergers and stuff,
yeah,
we're about to hit a pricing maelstrom. It's going to be a hurricane of pricing. I'm glad I'm distilling, and I'll leave it at that. But the price that it costs in order for you to make a bottle of whiskey, the difference between the cost of rye, corn, wheat, all of those things, in my opinion, are pretty damn close to irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
It really doesn't cost that much more, and of course that's a lot of the reason that we're doing it. Now, this is of course at the size plant we are now. When you get to the size of the big boys, the cost of grain doesn't mean a damn thing.
Yeah.
Today in 2015, now in the 80s, when they couldn't give the stuff away, that made a huge difference. And they're selling, you know, 10 and 12 year old bottles of whiskey for $9.99 because nobody was buying it. Yeah. Then it made a difference.
It still surprises me how some, you see some bottles on the shelf of bourbon
Oh, yeah.
and like, and it's, And people will say, well, it's so, look, it's so, I'm like, well, how, why is it so inexpensive? I'm not really sure, but.
Yeah, it's just left over from when they really couldn't give it away. And what you have to understand, what they're running is, the big difference between us and the big guys is they're running continuous stills.
Yeah, yeah.
The continuous stills just absolutely eat up grain and barrels and everything else. And you just get thousands and thousands of barrels out of those things. It's just running nonstop. And when you're doing that, the cost of the bottle is more than the cost of the liquid that's in there. It's the same economies of scale you wind up getting almost for vodka. You know, where Grey Goose, it's, you know, the old adage, was it Mr. Bronfman? I can't remember who was it that said this, but, you know, what's the difference between a $22 bottle of vodka and a $32 bottle of vodka? $10 in profit was the answer. Because the cost to make it is completely irrelevant, no matter, you know, whether they talk about filtering 20 times or 19 mm-hmm. or distilling it, whatever bullshit they want to peddle or sell.
Yeah.
So the cost of the grains it really doesn't matter. How that said, large corporations care about that.
Yeah.
And so they want to squeeze every last penny they can out of the grain that they get. The way that we look at it is the exact opposite. We have a privilege that we have, you know, that, again, farmers will actually, you know, plant what it is we want. So we've got hundreds of acres out there. We can't believe it, that they're planting exactly what it is I'm asking them to plant. And what do they get in return? They get a premium.
Yeah.
So as he was explaining it, you know, for Michigan, he's paying a 30-40% premium. You know, we're doing the same thing here. But that's okay. I'm proud of that. I'm very, very happy to be, you know, being in a position where we can do more than just, you know, make spirits. Not that I'm not proud of what we're doing here, but I'm much prouder that, you know, think about how many plates of food that's putting on the table throughout the state, which is, you know, to me much, much more important than you know, what it is we're doing here overall. So because we are a small distillery and because we're charging somewhere between $44 on the shelf for a bottle of whiskey, we can afford to pay a little bit more for what we're doing with our farmers, and it just feeds on itself.
Well, and, you know, a lot of it comes down to you're also paying them what it's worth. I mean,
yeah.
Like, these,
oh, absolutely. You know, no, we're paying the real market value.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
They do get, I think, in this really horrible cycle with these large corporations that they have these huge lots of land and they can't afford to lose these contracts. You know, like, this is what we're willing to pay for it. Take it or leave
the
it.
Race to the bottom.
Exactly. So it's, you know, it's
the, what they say with Walmart, with the people
the pickle, the pickle story.
To Walmart.
Yeah.
Right. Well, wow. They come in and say, the good news is we got Walmart as a customer. The
bad news
is
we got
Walmart
as a customer. I wish I could remember. It's one of the oldest stories. So there was a large pickle company that they got a contract, but they had to create like these humongous jars of pickles for like a dollar.
Vlasic, I think.
It almost put them under. Because what they had done was increased their production. So of course the facility to keep up with the production for this, they couldn't afford to lose Walmart, but they weren't making any money.
Right. So, can't afford to keep them.
Exactly.
To lose
and
them.
For
yeah.
right. And for Walmart, all that was like just one of those lost leaders where they're bringing this product. It's this like crazy, ridiculously low product to keep people coming in the door. So there have been, and there's more than just the I think the pickle was the first that this was like that first story where
Rubbermaid got it. And, you know, the only reason I don't feel too bad for those companies is that for decades, the shoe was on the other foot.
Exactly.
So what they would do was say, if you don't carry our entire line, you get nothing.
Yeah.
If you don't push X, Y, and Z, you get nothing. You see some of the,
what
some
goes
of the
around,
people doing
comes
with
around.
The distributors doing that with, what the hell, Pappy Van Winkle. If you want Pappy Van Winkle, you have to carry,
our Drac.
You know, 100 cases of bubblegum-flavored margarita mix or whatever the hell it was.
Exactly.
I don't feel that horrible in that sense, that what goes around comes around. But anyway... So for the we also installed a new still, and this was a still that was popular in the 1800s, and this still is what's known as a three chamber still, and it's kind of a.
And this is Vendome made for you, right? Give them a little shout out. Didn't Vendome make this for you?
Oh, absolutely, they did. I got to work with
awesome.
Them on.
Yeah.
It's they did wonderful work. It looks like something that fell out of a Jules Verne novel, I think, or off the Titanic, or I don't know what. Yeah. And so what it is.
That's what my brew house looks like, too.
Well, I can imagine. They do. Oh, yeah. I've seen some of their brew houses, and they're just beautiful. They're excellent. They are wonderful welders out there, and they take an awful lot of pride in what they're doing. And it's neat to see what the resurgence in brewing and distilling has done to Vendome. You know, it's where they weren't really didn't have a whole hell of a lot of business. And now I think their wait list is up to a year and a half. I don't know. I'm sure that's been reduced.
I know. I need to get them on a show. I think Sean, one of the welders, I could probably get on here. Huh.
They would be absolutely fascinating to talk to, particularly the Shermans, because what they'll be able to do is really, they are going to be able to walk you through, you know, really the history of bourbon production. You know, they make all the spills for everybody. So they'll be able to tell you about the good times and the bad and, you know, trying to make it through this. But the part I find fascinating is that all the welders show up. What they're really certified in doing is welding together HVAC ducts. So you get a kid that shows up at Vendome, is 22 years old, and, you know, hot shot kid with his union card, and shows up and says, yeah, hey, I'm here to weld. And, of course, they just laugh and, you know, think you don't know shit about shit, kids. Stand over here and watch what we're doing. And so the work that they do is just absolutely beautiful. And going to the shop is, if you're ever in that neck of the woods, I highly recommend it. It's just a beautiful, beautiful old building. And they've been making stills for a very long time. And when we came to them to do this still, I think it's suffice it to say that I thought I was a little crazy, because this is the type of still that was really something that the old timers talked about. So what it is it's basically a half measure. I'm totally monopolizing the conversation.
You're not.
After this, somebody shut up. So this type of still, it's about 20 feet tall, and it's kind of a half measure between a continuous still and a pot still. So a continuous still, you know, we're talking Wild Turkey or Sazerac or Buffalo, any of those guys. They basically have a large still that'll be, you know, 3 feet in diameter, maybe four at the most. And it runs up, you know, two, three stories. And
what's those columns, the real straight?
It's a column. And you inject, basically you have your batch fermenters, but it's feeding what's called the beer well. So the beer well is just a surge tank that's always being topped off with fermented bourbon mash or rye mash. And this pumps into the top of the still, or near the top, I'm simplifying here, a constant stream of about 6% alcohol, bourbon or rye mash into the side of the still. The still is designed so that that mash kind of cascades down the column like on a set of alternating stairs. I'm really oversimplifying things here, but so as it cascades down, you inject live steam from the bottom, and that live steam, as the mash is passing through it, strips the alcohol and the flavor of the raw materials out, and that steam is going to be laden with alcohol and flavors, and it's eventually going to hit a condenser. And that condenser is just, you know, cold water surrounding pipes, again, simplifying things. And it's going to condense and come out as alcohol. So alcohol comes out of one end, the stillage comes out of the other. Stillage just means the grain after you've pulled the yeast, everything else after you've pulled all the alcohol off. So these operate continuously, 24/7. Those suckers are running, and it's get thousands and thousands of gallons of alcohol out. And if the size of a column, to nerd out for a second, is the capacity that is simply determined by its diameter. So whenever anybody talks about columns and likes to nerd out how many inches in diameter is it. So most of the big guys is somewhere between 36 and 48. Some of the smaller distillers have 24-inch columns, which are way the hell too big for the amount of whiskey that they're making, but that John Little could confirm that there. We said John Little.
John Little got his shout out.
Pot still is what everybody imagines in Scotland, and that's a charge still. So the column still, it's running 24/7. You're never stopping it. It's not recharging. A pot still, you take fermented beer, distiller's beer, whatever you want to call it, and you put it into that pot. You bring it to a boil, the vapor comes out, it condenses as alcohol. When you're done and you've pulled all that alcohol out, you shut the still off, you get all of that grain out, or you get all of the wash out if it's been lautered, and then you charge it again. It's much less efficient. But it's what they use in Scotland, it's what they use in Ireland as well, where they have column stills there. But anyways, what a three-chamber still does is kind of a half measure. So the way that it works is you have three chambers, and you fill each one of them with newly fermented mash out of the same type of beer well that you see in the continuous still. You're bubbling live steam through it, but you're charging each one. And when you bubble the live steam through it, it goes through the first chamber, bubble up through the second chamber, up through the third chamber. And each one of the chambers has a swan's neck.
Mm-hmm.
You can picture just that, and all that's designed is so that you can pump the steam up through it, and it's designed so that that mash sits in each individual chamber. If you don't have that swan's neck, obviously, and you try and bubble steam through it, all of the liquid just falls down to the bottom chamber.
So right.
The swan's neck is there designed so that you're holding a few hundred gallons of mash in each chamber. So you bubble the steam through it, and in about 20 minutes, you've got whiskey that goes to the condenser, and you draw it off, and it goes directly into a barrel. You don't have to do anything else to it. You don't have to distill it a second time. There's nothing like that. And then the bottom chamber, you've pulled all the alcohol out, so you pump that out to stillage. The next chamber above it, you drain it so that it moves down to the bottom chamber. The chamber above that moves down, and the chamber above that moves down. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So that you're basically distilling off one chamber at a time.
Yeah, okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So when you're running it through this, when you're running that steam through a batch, it takes about 20 minutes. So after that 20 minutes, you're done, and you're going to take the bottom chamber, and it goes off to stillage, and then move each chamber down one, and then you top off that last one with new mash. So what this means is by the time you're finished, first of all, you're running live steam through about 10 feet of rye mash. And second of all, you're getting 10 feet of rye mash, you're getting an hour's worth of steam, as opposed to the column still I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The time it takes for that mash to start at the top and to wind up at the bottom is 90 seconds.
And what's the advantage? So what would be, are you extracting more flavor?
I'm extracting a lot more flavor. Okay. Instead of the rye getting exposed to 90 seconds worth of steam treatment, mm-hmm. you're getting an hour.
And so it's like a big rye tea.
So you're getting, not only are you getting the alcohol out, you're getting a lot more flavor of that mash
mm-hmm.
out.
Mm-hmm.
And as you were asking me to ask why rye is such a pain in the ass, rye is a compound in it called beta-glucan. So most brewers despise rye. It's foam, it's gummy, you can't powder it, it's impossible to run off. There's a million reasons why rye is a pain in the ass. Well, this, I'm not cooking it on a pot. So we're doing an 80% rye to 20% malted barley. And when you put it into it, if I try to put this into a large pot still and bring it to a boil, foam would come gushing out of it. It would be absolutely a mess. I can't even imagine trying to do it.
My favorite rye story is when Dave Pickerel was over at Mount Vernon, and it was the first time he had done 100% rye. And the thing, I can't even remember the dimensions of the foam, but like they walked in and it was just, I mean, it was everywhere. And he didn't want to use the surfactant to lower.
Keep it down, yeah.
The surface tension, yeah.
Yeah.
The old way they used to, I've seen everything from lard is something they would, rub on the inside of
the back in the. Because Todd reads like these old antique. I love when you talk about some of the books you're reading. Because, I don't want to say he nerds out, but like this, I mean, he is reading that, like when they first started distilling, those are the books. And he's like, and I'm on chapter whatever of nothing you're ever going to understand reading this.
I like how you preface
that. I'm trying to revive these old lost styles, and I apologize. It's very, very difficult to explain a three-chamber still without a drawing.
We went through this last time. You have got to stop apologizing. Yeah. I love having you on here purely because you do talk about this stuff. I mean, some like Matt Pond, I hope he's getting... I mean, you're so great at making this stuff really... you think that it's an easy approach, but I think it's... Or excuse me, that it's that you're simplifying, but I think it's more approachable for somebody who doesn't understand distilling to really grasp what you're talking about.
I mean, both conversations today have been like the most inspiring and for me to
see. Are you going to say? Are you going to thank me? You going to thank me for making you come on?
Fine, but yeah, they're both really enlightening and really like inspiring at the same time. It's,
yeah,
there's a lot going on, and it's similar stories, but it's making sense. So
yeah.
I don't feel like a complete idiot.
You're never a complete idiot.
Well, you're not. If it means anything, we had Green Fury in the jukebox.
Oh, no way.
One of his albums.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't remember that. That's an old one.
I'm a hardcore old indie rock nerd. So the jukebox that we had in there, I stocked it myself. And what I would do was, we didn't have a whole lot of money, especially to start off. So I'd call the interns at, Merge and Matador and Rough Trade and, hey, I'm happy to put this in. What do you got that's new?
And, that's awesome.
Some of them we paid for, and some of them we just here put in whatever the hell it is that's new. And for a time, we did live music there before neighbors started complaining. But we were we had of Montreal in, we had Essex Green in, and the Gore.
Oh, awesome!
We were just starting. I was just getting to know John Roderick from The Long Winters. And, God, who else did we meet? I am blanking on his name. Ben Gibbard. Jesus Christ. That was bad.
Yeah.
with the first Postal Service album, and he was looking neat places to play. And so we were just, this is another, very much another passion of mine. So instead of, we started to learn about Clear Channel, speaking of corruption.
I know this story.
So we were just starting to understand how that whole stupid game is played, and then unfortunately they shut it down. But, we bottled quite a bit of beer to your music, so... Let's let somebody else talk.
Well, there's a couple things I want to cover before we end up going. When will the rye that the Schlegels have grown for you, like, when will that whiskey hit the market? You can't say for sure because it's aging.
Somewhere between 2 and 4 years.
It's only just gone into barrels, right?
Yeah, we only have put down a few barrels right now. So what we're hoping, what we'll be releasing it is a bottled and bond expression.
Oh.
That means it did 50% ABV. And I won't be able to tell you for about maybe a year and a half. I suspect we're going to be looking toward. These are very, very big rise. And the reason that we built this is, first of all, every 20 minutes I'm getting about a half of a barrel, which for us is a lot. So that's why I mean it's a half. What I meant before, it's a half measure between a continuous still and a pot still.
Right.
Get quite a bit of whiskey out of it, which really solves the problem. It handles the rye because you're using direct steam instead of a hot copper surface, the way that you do in the pot that leads to all that foaming that we keep talking about. One of the studies that I had read was what would eventually become the BATF or the TTB today. They did a survey of distilleries. They took 20-some-odd distilleries in 1898 and it broke everything down. What's the mash bill? What did you make? What kind of still? And then they did samples from it. They sampled the new make and then every year for the next 6 years out of a barrel. And if you look at the stuff that was made in a column still, the rye that was made in a column still versus a three chamber still, and you look at a gas chromatograph for it, the wavy lines that you see for the three chamber still are just enormous. These are very, very, very big, flavorful whiskeys. Can't replicate.
I can't wait.
Using any other method. So it's
the grains and the three chamber still. It's like you've got these two things together that I can't wait to taste this whiskey.
It's the way I could describe the distillate and the finished whiskey, if you made a Manhattan out of it and you stirred it with the spoon and you pull the spoon out, the whiskey may come out. It's just very, very thick. Very, very heavy, and this, of course, is what, as I started to explain, and went off on a tangent as I do, this is the type of whiskey that really fell out of favor. So, I started to say, as they went over, for World War II and all the rationing, we're basically getting to more mild flavors. And, you know, a lot of the foods in America in the 50s and 60s, if you went outside of ethnic enclaves, you know, everything tasted like boring. It's just really salty.
Mashed potatoes.
And really, that's it.
If you think about Prohibition, the only access that people had, of course, like the stuff out of Canada, which did have a high rye mash bill, I think, right, Todd?
It did, but the way that they distilled it,
it lessened the flavor. People had access to, if you think about what was being brought into the country, was spirits that were coming from Britain. So these were much.
You're back
just
to the
milder,
pot still.
Just softer. And so that spiciness that would have been, if you think about like what the diet became, like when he's talking about, you know, 50s and 60s and 70s, like that would have just been so, if you think about like why, like in the US, we've just discovered vinegar. We've just discovered, I mean, there's so many, like the bitters, the Amaros, you know, these things like that just would never have, the Americans just would never have been open to it. And they've only recently started to really accept these things.
Like about 10 minutes ago.
Exactly.
Earlier in the show. Yeah.
I know. There's a couple of things I want to get into because we didn't have your Fernet the last time that you were on. And there was something I want to remember before we get off the air that, Dragon's Milk from, New Holland, which is probably one of their biggest beers, like most popular beers, they're going to be doing four different releases this year that's going to be with the Dragon's Milk Reserve. So the first one coming out is a chai vanilla, so people should look for that now or sometime this month. And then the next one is going to be a chocolate and cocoa one. And so I'll share as the guys let me know what the next ones are, I'll let everybody else know. But so the last show that we did, and we did it with Ken Schramm, and we had Ron from Jolly Pumpkin. I thought it was pretty interesting. Matt had asked a great question, and he was asking, what was that?
It sounded dumb the way I asked.
No, you didn't. I think that Todd and possibly Bert are just for what they're doing. I think they're probably better, or maybe they will answer the question. Better. I don't know how else to say that. I think the guys maybe, the show was running long, and I think it might have been like, I just don't want to get into this. So the question that Matt, why don't you go ahead and ask your question?
It's just where does bacteria fit in with a lot of what, especially beer?
So
and how can you anticipate its reaction to what's going down?
And he was looking for kind of like a versus, like understanding like the
yeast and bacteria interplay.
Yeast, right. What yeast plays in fermentation and bacteria. And what I thought was really interesting was, remember Robert posed a really similar question about when you're doing the open fermentation, how do you control? And you really touched on stuff. And of course, Matt, he's not on Facebook. And I thought the conversation was so interesting. He would have loved to have seen it. And Dave Pickerell had weighed in as well. So I think you guys, especially on the distilling side, and I think Bert has been brewing for so long, and maybe I think he could probably answer this, but I would love for you to help make that in the way that you do. So understand, you know, that I think you just explained the stuff where Matt will understand it well.
Sure. If you're directing that at me,
yes.
The way that the bacteria is handled in distilling is different than brewing. So the step that brewers have that the distillers don't have. Now we're talking ale and lager production, mm-hmm. and sour beers is the boil. So what they're doing is they're basically sanitizing all of those grains that come in. So when you're mashing, you're basically mashing whatever grain is. So if we're making bourbon, it's corn, rye, and barley. If you're making a beer, you're doing 100% malted barley. Or to simplify things, you can obviously use whatever you want. But what they're doing is you're basically mixing hot water together with these grains. So basically, you've got all the bacteria and wild yeast that lives on this grain out on the field. And if you do not boil it, it is still active on that grain. So as a brewer, you're going to mash it. You're going to, you know, mix it with hot water. The warm water is going to activate enzymes that's in the malted barley. The malted barley enzymes are going to break down the starches into simple sugars, and that's what the yeast is going to eat. So when you're mashing, you can just think of it as you're making food for yeast. So the yeast can't consume starches. You need to convert those starches into simple sugars. So that's why you did that process I just explained. From there, you put it in a louder tun, or it's already in a louder tun. A louder tun is just a fancy colander, basically. So you're going to separate the solids from the liquid, and you take the liquid and you boil it and you add the hops. So you're killing all of the wild yeast and bacteria that came from that grain. In distilling, the warmest temperature that you're going to use, even if you boil the corn, a lot of the gelatinization point of corn is higher. So basically what that means is what temperature do you need for the cell walls to dissolve? The cell walls, you can think of it like a honeycomb, and on the inside of these millions of honeycombs is the starch that you want to get to. So first you have to dissolve the cell wall. And you do that by, you know, using heat. So when you get up to that warmer temperature, the cell walls dissolve, exposing the starch to enzyme reduction. So if you're making a bourbon, most of the guys use what's called a corn cooker. You boil the corn to simplify things here. At that point, you've blown away all of the cell walls. Now you have starch. You cool it down, and you add malted barley. And now all the distilleries, we're talking big guys now, will use somewhere between 5 and maybe 15% malted barley. There's enough enzymes in that. You take that corn, you cool it down to temperatures that won't kill the enzymes, you know, 140, something like that, and you add the malted barley to it. The malted barley enzymes will break down those starches into simple sugars, just like it is in brewing. And then you cool it down from those 140s, which is not sterile. You need to really go north of 180 degrees before you're killing all of those bacteria. You cool it down, and you're going to pump it into a fermenter. So the fact that this is something that I'm answering this question a lot lately. The fact that you're using open fermenters is almost irrelevant. The fact that you're using wooden fermenters is almost irrelevant in the sense that you are taking a massive number of bacteria in that mash coming from that malted barley that was not boiled. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because you're not boiling off to kill everything. So you're allowing enough stuff to survive for you to work with.
The biggest bugs that are in there and bacteria wise are lactobacillus, but you'll also get some acetobacter and some other things. So the easiest question to get to this, if you ever have a brewer on the phone, is ask them what their microbiological stability would be if they can't boil their wort. You get dead silence from them for a couple minutes while they try to conjure mind.
Well, yeah, I think
meant.
That was kind of what he was faced with. And I don't know if Bert, if you have anything that you want to say about this, but I also I think also Matt's question last week was what are the flavors that the bacteria impart? So when you talk about lactobacillus,
okay, can finish that up real quick. So what happens in distillation is the way that you get a nice estuary beer, some nice fruit notes out of some of the Belgian beers and some of the, you know, other ones that are out there. You usually either use specific yeast strains that tend to give you these esters, or think Hefeweizen if you've ever had one that has a nice banana note, right, or pear note, isoamyl acetate, that kind of thing. That comes from a nice yeast strain and mucking around with the temperature so that the yeast gives off that byproduct during fermentation. For distillation, in my opinion, you can make a bourbon mash that has those estery notes, but a lot of those esters stay behind in the stills after distillation. So in other words, when you're boiling it and turning it into a vapor, a lot of the esters stay behind in that pot that I mentioned, or goes out with the stillage in terms of the continuous still that I mentioned. So a more effective way of doing it, and this is really the difference between distilling and brewing fermentation, in my opinion, is that you allow these bacteria, lactic acid bacteria, acetic acid bacteria, to work to consume some of that substrate. So the way that everybody does it, whether we're talking sour beer, whether we're talking about what I'm doing, first you make a beer, just a regular old beer. You add yeast to it. The yeast consumes all the fermentable sugars, and then it's done. If you're making a sour beer for, like, at New Belgium, for instance, they take that beer and they move it into a wooden tank that's been inoculated with lactic acid bacteria, for instance. Lactic acid bacteria is so named because when it consumes food, it gives off lactic acid. And that's where the sour comes from. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, so that lactic acid bacteria can consume things that the yeast can't. So dextrins, lignocellulose, little scraps. It doesn't take that much food for the lactobacillus to consume some of those things. So for a sour beer brewer, they want that bacteria to lend that lactic acid bacteria to get lactic acid into the beer so that it has a nice sour note. As a distiller, what I want are organic acids that are going to pass through into the distillate. So when you taste my bourbon, you know, I do a primary fermentation. The yeast consumes all of the sugars. It produces an alcoholic beer at about 5% alcohol. I let it sit for an extra couple days. And lactobacillus that came in with that grain, that, you know, I'm generalizing here. There's more varieties of bacteria and different strains that are at work, but we're stick to the lactic acid bacteria. It's going to consume some of that substrate, and it's going to give off those organic acids that I mentioned. When I distill it twice, those organic acids show up in the distillate, and then when I put that into a barrel, there's a reaction called esterification that occurs. So all that means is when you have an organic acid in an alcohol solution, i.e. whiskey, you add oxygen, those barrels are gas permeable, so oxygen works its way into the barrel, reacts with those and combines with those organic acids to create esters. So if I have a nice fermentation, I get some acetic acid bacteria, for instance, and that consumes some of that substrate. I distill it twice. I put it in a barrel. That acetic acid will react with isobutanol and some other compounds and oxygen to make what's called isobutyl acetate, and that tastes like raspberries. Does that make sense?
And it's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. I mean, it's not because it's just science, I guess, but how you can have a beer that has a fruit profile with adding no fruit. Matt, to answer, like, that's where these things play together and you get that. And Bert, so can you explain to Matt the difference between kettle souring and then souring that occurs with, like, in a photo, or like when you're using wood, how they differ?
Yeah, I've never done any kettle souring. Now, I was just talking with Tim Surprise from Arcadia this last weekend, and they've got a beer that they did for their 19th anniversary where they added yogurt into the kettle.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I did a kettle sour that way, which I've never done before. It was interesting, but I couldn't get it out of my head that the beer I was tasting tasted like Dannon. You know, it's like, because it had cherries in it too. And I literally felt like I perceived a yogurty kind of taste to it, which may or may not be there. But all my stuff was done when I was doing sour beers. I don't do them now because production facility does Blue Sunday and Mischievous and all that stuff. And I don't want to, like, step on anybody's toes. Yeah. So I do a little bit different thing. But when I was doing that, I basically would just leave a bung off a wood barrel and let the air blow through and do what it wanted to do with wild, you know, spontaneous fermentations. And, you know, I never got into it like some of these guys do, like even Ron Jeffries, you know. So anyways, you know, I just right now, sours aren't really the thing I'm doing, so...
Before we sign off, it's funny because I think we did talk about it on the show, but Matt did say that he is dying to try the Highland Amaro, and I had planned on us drinking it. So we did talk about your Fernet on the last show, but I think it would be kind of cool to talk about. And I'm so glad that you both joined. I think this was a great show. I think that they're both two guys that we could talk to a lot more. Todd, I've talked about having some shows where I think since you just covered so much of, like, the beginning of distilling, I did talk about maybe we should do shows where we do talk to people about, so they understand this process more. I think he covered like half of it.
Yeah.
But I would love to have you back for like finishing stuff and talking about barrels. I mean, you're just, you explain, I mean, both you and Bert were, are so great at explaining stuff.
Yeah, I really
love it. Yeah, and a lot of listeners just really, they're consumers. So they just, you know, they want to enjoy it. But I think it's really, it's great for them to understand how the process that...
Well, how those little nuances of flavor come about. I mean, you're talking about that esterification in the barrel. I mean, that's something that, you know, from a sensory standpoint, we can pick that up in the glass and... Now we can kind of trace this back through your whole process.
Where did this come from? Well, and you know, like I had said to Matt, you know, he's so interested in distilling, and what I told him, like, it's just as important for you to talk to brewers as distillers. I mean, Todd's a perfect example. He started out doing this as a brewer. And as a distiller, what you start doing before you distill is create a beer. So understanding beer production is incredibly important when you talk about distilling. And like, you know, so it's, I know sometimes it seems like, why are you asking me to be on, not on this show, but I but do you like, there's like these things start to,
are you talking to me?
No, the dots start to feel you start to see the connection, I hope. And the dots, like, I think maybe when I, maybe cause I don't explain all this stuff to him, I'm just like, no, you should listen and you should be part of this. But,
no, it's mesmerizing.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's just, I just love both the description of how just the previous bacteria thing, but all the stuff that's going on in Michigan and the stuff that you're doing with that's happening with old grains. And I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot to take in. That's why sometimes it's like,
I've stressed him out.
You know? There's a lot of information happening.
But
just remember, we're old and we've been doing this for a long time. but I love it. That's the thing. It's pretty cool. So I appreciate it.
You know, there's a really good book out there that has nothing to do with beer or distilling, but it's awesome. It's by Dan Barber.
Yes.
Who's a chef in New York, and it's called The Third Plate. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he ventures into a couple chapters about crossing for barley, and this old marijuana grower in Washington State is working for the state of Washington as a maltster, and he's talking about crossing different types of heirloom barleys now for brewers in the Yakima area and such. Anyways, it's pretty interesting to, you know, read this about, you know, what barley and these grains, like Todd's talking about the rye and stuff, what it used to be compared to what it is now. And, you know, we can go into a corn and soybean discussion as well, but that's a whole other show, you know, or two or three. But, you know, how it rapes the soil and how, like, heirloom wheat had taproots 35 feet long and now they're 18 inches. And, you know, amber waves of grain were 8-9 feet tall and now they're 36 inches. You know, so combines can, you know, harvest them and you get your crappy Wonder Bread bleached out junk, you know. It's the same thing with a lot of, you know, the barley we get, you know, from Europe or even, you know, our Brees, you know, no diss on them because they're doing a great job. But I have just noticed the quality of what I'm doing with my local, not necessarily local, but Michigan-sourced grains and knowing the farmers. It's just different. I mean, the flavors hold longer. There's no malt degradation in my beers over 2 or 3 months when they're on tap. The hop character stays there. To me, that's worth it. I mean, that's like buying really good beef or, you know, really fresh vegetables at the farm market, and you bring them home and a week later you use them and they're still good, you know? I just feel like people work really hard for their money these days. And there's not people, a lot of people don't have disposable income. But when those people come into your pub and drop hard-earned coin on your product, you owe them the best, freshest product you can do. And the best way to do that, in my opinion, is to use local. So.
Well, and Dan, we actually did Stone Barn Fences. Dan, we featured Dan as a do-gooder a couple of issues ago. And you're right.
Cool.
Let's talk about Fernet Leopold before we sign off. I'm getting like,
yes, ma'am.
I love, yes, ma'am. What? I didn't curse. That's why he's calling me ma'am. Like I just please tell Mama Leopold that I was so clean on this show. I did not say one curse word.
I think I've swore more than you did.
I'm glad.
I may be in trouble with her.
Hi, Mama Leopold.
So the Fairnet is, it was the, you know, first American-made Fairnet.
Mm-hmm.
In recent memory. I know it's been made before because there was a Fairnet Branca plant in New Jersey for a time. Making it, or bottling it, or both. I'm sorry, both, excuse me. But Fairnet is just, to me, it's the way I look at different Amaros is kind of look at the structure of how it's made. So, for instance, an aperitivo, which we also make.
I know, that's new. I haven't had that yet. I have to try that.
We'll fix this. Aaron's finally not sick. So.
No, well, to explain to people that... And we talked about this on your last show. I do want you to finish this. When we talked about all of the different liqueurs that you make, out of necessity in Michigan, Todd had to perfect making liqueurs because he was not allowed to buy them and sell them, you know, cocktails made in his bar. So they've actually now, in addition to all these other gorgeous liqueurs, which I'm telling you that I have grown men that sit around this table ooing and aahing over your fruit liqueurs. They drink them straight. Don't look at me like that. You know it's true.
I'm looking at you like, where's that bottle of that blackberry stuff? I will drink that dry.
I actually said
heartbeat.
To him, if I can't find any whiskey here, the boys are going to want to drink the blackberry liqueur.
That stuff is phenomenal.
It is phenomenal.
Tell
them about the because the aperitivos knew that what they if you're a Negroni fan and you want to try something amazing, which I haven't tried yet, but I've heard from everybody who's had it that you need to get his aperitivo and you would use that in lieu of the other red liqueur that you would put in your
given
Negroni.
Given the pedigree of what we tasted tonight, I would be.
You're on board.
On board, for sure.
So it's aperitivo is a style. It's very, very sweet and very, very bitter, and with usually kind of lowish alcohol content. So all the way until 2006, both Campari and Aperol would color it with cochineal.
Yeah,
cochineal is a type of, it's a beetle. Mm-hmm. It grows in Peru is where we get ours. It was very common all through the big trade phase as America was slowly being discovered, in quotes, that cochineal and farming of cochineal was a very big part of Mexico's economy. It was the number two export for a good 100 years, second only to silver. And basically it's a beetle with a very, very bright red, basically liquid when you crush them that comes out. And the easiest way I can describe it to people is think British redcoats.
Yeah.
That's where the red came from.
Oh!
It came from cochineal. So it was used in textiles. It was used in liqueurs like, of course, Campari and Parfait Amour and some creme de Yvette. A lot. It was very, very commonly used to as a colorant. So,
as opposed to red food dye number four.
Red dye number 40. we had a couple of vegetarians giving us a hard time for it, and I understand, you know, where they're coming from. But what you have to ask is when you're talking about doing food replacement, you have to ask, okay, well, what are you replacing it with? And so red dye number 40 actually comes from coal. So if you had to guess,
right, which you're
what's harming more animals, coal, or, you know, another example would be Guinness. You know, Guinness famously went from isinglass.
Yep.
They switched off of using isinglass relatively recently.
Do you want to explain what that is, the fish?
Well, isinglass is fish bladder, and it's electrically charged, and it's what's used to clarify basically the Lautrec cold troop protein compounds in yeast, and it's used as a clarifier. It bonds with it, and it makes filtration a little bit easier if you're filtering, or it makes it so you can decant off the liquid if you're not. And it's been used for hundreds of years. Well, what they don't say is what they replaced it with. They didn't just stop using it. They weren't using fish bladders for the hell of it. they were using it because it performed the function, and now they replaced it with what's called PVPP. PVPP is basic, it's plastic, so of course another petroleum product.
Right.
So people need to be a little bit more. It's the problem, or one of the problems with environmentalism. If you're not a trained engineer or brewer, very often you can wind up robbing Peter to pay Paul, I guess, where, you know, maybe the cure isn't really what you want it to be.
I get a lot of people that, you know, email me or call and want to know if my beer is vegan.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, well, you know, I use Irish Moss Copper Clear to, you know, kettle sign it, mm-hmm. and then I DE filter my beer. But we just don't tell them that yeast is a one-celled organism. So technically, you know,
that is awesome.
No, I mean, it's one of those things. It's a very it's a delicate thing because these are good people and they're you know trying to make choices. And,
oh yeah, I'm not.
You know, you're trying to help them, but it's really hard to. I mean, we've touched on, you know, gluten.
Yeah.
Before it can be, it's just going to be a touchy thing, and I get it. You're putting it into your body. It's a very personal. It doesn't get much more personal than that. You know, I understand when people do this, and you just try and politely, you know, sometimes I'll have that, you know, explanation as to what red dye number 40 is, and sometimes you realize that, you know, maybe that this isn't worth walking them all the way down the road on this conversation. But anyway, so that's the aperitivo. I'm sorry, and it's bittered with gentian root. So all these amaros, well, the one thing that they have in common, or at least in my opinion, have in common is it has a amaro gentian in it, mm-hmm. coming from somewhere. Mm-hmm. So amaro gentian, it's something that it's found in large quantities in gentian root.
Yeah,
gentian root is the main bittering component for our aperitivo, for Campari, for Aperol, for a lot of these things will have that. The difference between us and some of the larger companies, and I'm not saying necessarily Campari or Aperol, but what I know for certain is that we don't add alum. So if you've ever had the bitterness where it's kind of chemically, or the bitterness, as I like to say, drops off the table.
Yeah.
What they're doing is they're adding alum, and alum is an astringent, and of course it's based on aluminum. So we don't use it because that's not food, in my opinion. That people will say that our aperitivo is much earthier. And the reason that they use that is that it gives you the bitterness that you get from gentian root, mm-hmm. but it doesn't cost anywhere near as much. So it's basically a gentian replacement. For the Fairnet, most of them are high in alcohol, and by high I mean 40%, which is usually at 40% or maybe even a little bit more. The bitterness is kind of all over the map. You know, some of them are more bitter than others. If I was a distiller in Europe, I could tell you that a Fairnet is designed as something to kind of settle your stomach. That's
you can't make those health.
I cannot. That's called a health claim. So European distillers will tell you that their Fairnets are designed as an after-dinner shot. So for us, what we did, the bittering component is Alloferox. Alloferox is basically, it's a resinous portion of the plant. It kind of tastes a bit like iodine, mm-hmm. in high quantities. It's in most of the Fairnets that are out there on the market. And it was actually put on the endangered plant list a year and a half ago. So you have to have some special licenses to get it. Africa is where you get it mostly. So that's the bitter driver for it. Because it's the only American-made one, I kind of worked through, okay, well, what am I going to put in that's American? And the thing we put in there that's most distinctive is spearmint.
Yeah.
It's very American. There's spearmint, there's peppermint. The biggest thing in there by weight is actually rose petals.
Really?
Rose petals.
Some more.
I was going to ask about that. Rose. It has a really floral
note. For some reason, I was like getting a little bit of like citrus. Yeah, like I felt like I could smell orange.
Rose petals, and it's rose petals, lavender, elderflower, a little bit of chamomile.
I was going to say cardamom. It has that kind of note to it.
Oh, no, there's cardamom in there. You're absolutely right.
Nice.
They're absolutely right. And all of these components are sweet together. There's also cocoa nibs in there, blackjack molasses, a little bit of distilled bergamot. It's kind of the kitchen could stink. But the fun thing is, as we're bringing new guys on, is that I steep these in bags in intervals. I don't put them all in at the same time.
Well, we talked about that on your last show, how you, because of the extraction, the temperatures.
The extraction rate is different.
I don't know why I didn't say the bergamot is what I always will throw. It's the bergamot that makes me think of citrus. It's so lovely. Yep. Yeah.
So all of anyways, we keep all of these for several weeks. We'll rack it off the sediment because it's unfiltered, like most of the things that we make. We put them in used Chardonnay barrels where they rest, and the oxygen works its way in and softens it, and then we bottle it. And the barrels, the last 2 years, went to Odell Brewing, and they use them for their Serenette Porter.
I want to thank you guys for joining us. Matt, thanks for sitting in. Bert, it was a pleasure. Bert, it was a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you. I would love to have other opportunities in the future. I'm going to contact you for something other than this show. And Todd, please come back. Teach us more.
Yes. I feel like we just scratched the surface here. I feel like we could do a history lesson on grain in America, but
on everything. Well,
I was certainly, if you don't mind me saying really quick here, I was certainly fascinated by what Bert is doing. Just congratulations. And
oh, yeah.
I just think what you're doing is amazing.
Well, when I come out skiing in Ingray in April, I'll bring you some beer.
Oh, God. Nice. Please do. Look me up, send me a note, show you around.
Yeah, I'll be in Denver for a couple days on my way out and my way back. So,
wonderful. We'll find a time to talk then. Wonderful. Cool.
Sounds good.
All right.
All right, guys. Thank you. So we had Bert from New Holland, of course, Todd from Leopold Brothers, Matt Pond. Thank you guys so much for joining us, and have a great night.
Thank you so much as well. It was really fun.
Yeah, it was. Thanks, guys.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Cheers, all.
Go back, repeat, trace the things that you don't want to see. With your hands and your hair.